Welcome to the Weekly Squeak, your weekly geeky squeak with me, Christian Schiller. I've been taking a little tiny break from the show the past couple of weeks, as you can see. Travel, I don't know, other reasons. Sometimes you just need a holiday. But I wanted to keep momentum up. And so what I'm actually going to do for the next couple of weeks before I get back on track with things is something of a something from the archives, shall we say. So for this first archive show, I'm actually going to reproduce an interview that I did last year with Sinclair Target of 2-Bit History. This was for the new podcast I attempted to start called The Enthusiastic Amateur, which, to be blunt, I was very busy at the time, and trying to launch a new podcast in the middle of being very busy was not a good idea, and it didn't really go anywhere. But I did a couple of really good interviews that never really got the audience listenerships that they deserved. So I'm going to reproduce two of those interviews over the next couple of weeks first, and then we'll see where we go from there. So I'm just leaving the show after this intro in its sort of edited entirety. So there's going to be some different music and different production values and things like that that maybe sound a little different from the usual weekly squeak. But I hope you enjoy, and I'll talk to you again soon. This is the Enthusiastic Amateur Podcast, a show about people and their passions. Welcome to the Enthusiastic Amateur, a new show from me, Christian Schiller. In the Enthusiastic Amateur, I talk to two different groups of people. I either talk to people who are professionally enthusiastic about a subject and want to get you enthusiastic about that subject too, or I speak to people who are enthusiastic about a subject and working on that subject in their spare time, but also want you to be enthusiastic too. So it's all about spreading enthusiasm and passion. For this first episode, our topic is the history of computing, and my guest is Sinclair. Now, we were discussing this before the show, but I'm still going to possibly get it wrong. Sinclair Target.
That is entirely correct.
But if you're American, you may just go say Target. Yep. Or actually English or Australian. There is a shop in America and Australia called Target. So, but being currently based in Europe, I thought I should double check. I don't know how familiar you are with British computing, but you have a very appropriate name for the blog as well.
That's true. I was just last week in San Francisco, and I went to the Computer History Museum, and I saw that they had a couple of Sinclair computers, so that was exciting.
They were not very well made.
They looked flimsy.
Oh, they were, definitely. And you have a blog with a couple of dozen stories, usually more long-form blog posts covering a variety of topics, of stories behind key moments in computing history. And these vary from some very old ones to some more recent. So let's start with just what prompted you to create the blog in the first place, and what itch were you trying to scratch when you did that?
I think that's a good way to frame it. I think it really was an itch or a compulsion. I really enjoy writing, and I enjoy the opportunity to write for an audience. So I think the blog was really kind of a vanity project, a way for me to have an opportunity to write something and then put it in front of people. And I think I decided to do the history of computing in particular, because that was just a topic that I thought was very interesting. And I noticed that there didn't seem to be a huge amount of writing out there about it. There's a lot of writing out there about the history of different corporations within the technology sector. So there are endless books about, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple and all these other companies. But there isn't a lot. I mean, very simple questions that you might ask yourself as a software engineer. And I was asking myself these questions. I mean, where did the JSON format come from? Why do all the top level directories on my computer have all these strange abbreviated names? I mean, what is the history of those names? Why is it USR for user instead of just, you know, the word user? It's one extra letter. You would have thought that would be okay, but all these interesting questions about why things are the way they are, and those are really historical questions. So I wanted to dive into that from a historical, from the technical side of it.
And I guess some of the topics you cover, like there's a few topics here which people have certainly covered before, I think, or I hope, like the story of Ada Lovelace, which we will talk about in a bit more detail. But some other things, like I know one of the posts that brought me to your blog in the first place was the one about RSS, which I know tech journalists especially wax lyrical about, but without ever really knowing exactly, yeah, why it was created the way it was created. And interestingly, I learned from that post. I do some tech writing work, documentation work and things like that. And I work for a company that has a product that is largely based on Atom feeds. And I had forgotten that Atom feeds and RSS come from the same origin. I did know it. I'd just forgotten about it. So you reminded me of that fact.
Yeah, it seems like people forget about things very quickly in the computing world. So, yeah.
One of the reasons I wanted to speak to you, and we started touching on this very quickly before we started recording, your name is Sinclair, which was, I'm pretty sure the company doesn't exist anymore, a computer company in the UK in the, was it the 80s and 90s, I guess, named after its founder, Clive Sinclair. And there's this film put out by Channel 4, one of the TV channels in the UK, called I should have looked up the exact title, but something like The Battle of the Micromen. And it's about the battle, in quote marks, between Sinclair and Acorn, who are another British computer company, for the BBC contract, for the BBC Micro, which in that period of time in the UK was a big deal. The BBC funded this computer program to bring educational computers into schools. And I'm just about old enough that I did use those computers. And the interesting thing about this story was that Sinclair was a successful company at the time. And Acorn was kind of the plucky underdog that wanted to do things right. But because of that, you know, they weren't as successful. But in the long run, Acorn ended up being far more lucrative because Acorn became ARM. And ARM is now everywhere, whereas Sinclair is pretty much dead. So, and that's kind of what interested me about computing history, these sort of things where it doesn't always turn out the way you expect, I guess, in the long run.
Right, and Acorn ended up with the contract for the BBC in the end, right?
I think I honestly can't even remember now. I think they did.
You're stealing my thunder a little bit because I'm thinking about writing about the BBC Micro.
Oh, I think you can.
Okay, yeah, an upcoming post. But yeah, I think Acorn went ahead and they were the ones who put out the BBC Micro. But yeah, I'm sure that would have been a huge win because I understand it was a very popular computer around the United Kingdom.
I'm not sure. I don't know. I mean, it was popular in that people remember it, but because it was to schools, I don't know how many they sold. I don't know.
Right.
It's sort of interesting like that. Whereas Sinclair was in people's homes.
Right.
And I mean, if you ever picked one up, which you have and I have, they're very, very poorly made. They have those horrible chiclet keyboards, which, you know, you basically got on cheap calculators and things like that. Yeah, but I think the story of Acorn is a fascinating story in itself anyway. So
yeah, absolutely.
Because, yeah, now the company that came out of them is in a lot of devices. Actually, feeding into that before we go off too much of a tangent, for ages I've been keeping a very close eye on SoftBank, the Japanese investment company, because they invest in all these strange esoteric big projects, like robotic systems and Uber and virtual reality operating systems and then ARM. And everyone worries about companies like Facebook and Google. And I'm thinking, no, you should really worry about SoftBank. And Wired recently just published an article on them, which I look forward to reading to see if they agree.
You know, oh, that's fascinating.
Putting all this money into all these far-flung places and lots of money too.
Right.
Anyway, that's into the modern world. Let's go back a few decades again. So far, yeah, I think you've covered a dozen or sort of two dozen stories. What has been your favorite so far?
I would say my favorite so far. I've really enjoyed the stories that have a bit of a political edge. And it's funny because I set out to write history, and you discover very quickly that a lot of history does, you do end up writing about political things, and the politics creeps in a little bit, even if you don't set out to write about it in the first place. But one article I wrote, which I really enjoyed writing about, was my article about the semantic web. So in the early 2000s, Tim Berners-Lee and some other people really thought that they were going to, you know, Tim Berners-Lee came out, he built the web. That was very successful. It was a open protocol. Everybody could use it. And it was this wonderful thing. And then he thought, you know, you could build upon it and you have a sort of, I think he might have called it at some point Web 3.0. But the idea that you have a whole another set of protocols on top of the web that just make the web smarter, and machines will be able to understand more about the web. It won't just be unstructured text. It'll be more structured and more powerful for it. And there's this great dream of building that in an open way, using all these standards. So it would be public the same way that all the standards that built the original web were. And it was this amazing vision. And it was just very interesting because it seemed to fall almost entirely flat on its face. It really went nowhere. And all these standards were put out, but nobody really uses them anymore. So it's this very interesting story, a bit like the story about RSS. I mean, they're very similar themes here, but these grand visions of what the web could be like. And today we have a web that looks nothing like that. Everything almost, I don't know, it'd be interesting to see the statistics on this, but it seems like, you know, half the content of the web today, at least, is in Facebook or in Twitter. That's where people publish. Mm. And it's not public and based on standards the way that Tim Berners-Lee thought it was. So that was a very interesting story about, you know, why didn't that come to fruition? And that's where you get the politics. I mean, is it really, maybe there are technical shortcomings to these standards, but I think the real answer is that just the web moved away because you had these large corporations move in and they're able to set up these platforms that monopolized a lot of the communication on the web.
I actually, because I think about this time, so you're talking about the early to mid 2000s, I was working a lot in content management systems, and I do remember a lot of these terms like RDF schema, mm-hmm. OWL, and I'm also just remembering GLAM, which, trying to look up GLAM on a search engine to remember what an acronym stands for is difficult. So
that's a new one. That's a new one for me. I've never heard of
GLAM. I remember it being somewhat related to the kind of arts and museum sector, another sort of form of ontologies for content. And I guess some of the reasons with Tim Berners-Lee came from academia.
Right.
So classifying things is always a big desire, whereas it's not necessarily what the general user wants to do.
Absolutely. I think the people who are most excited about these standards were probably librarians.
Yeah. Why do you think it failed? I mean, what did you pick up from the story why you think it failed?
Well, there's a man out there, Cory Doctorow, who is famous for all sorts of things, but he was involved in some of the debates in the early 2000s about whether this was all a good idea. And he wrote a very influential essay where he basically argued that the whole idea was a little bit flawed. And his real point was that you were relying on people out there on the internet just to add all this metadata to their content. So if you're going to have this semantic web, you have to structure your information. And that means somebody who's only interested in putting out a bunch of text now has to take on the additional responsibility of structuring their information according to all these standards. Mm. And of course, if you've ever tried to go understand what exactly RDF schema is, I mean, I think I understood it for about 5 minutes as I was writing that article. I definitely don't understand it anymore. So it's just a very complicated thing. And it's part of the problem is that all these standards are very general purpose. So they're extremely abstract, and it's very hard to understand how you're supposed to apply them to, you know, any piece of content that you put out yourself. So I think the huge shortcoming was that there are some expectation that people would do all this stuff for their content because the semantic web would be so great. But I think it was almost a chicken and an egg problem because you needed these people to do this markup on their content in order to make the semantic web happen. But until there was a semantic web, there was really no incentive for people to do it. Hmm.
And I think this is another one of these classic stories that the history of computing, indeed the history of technology, is littered with, where the better standard, in quote marks, especially from the engineer's perspective, doesn't always end up winning. And its legacy is still with us, but in different ways. So some forms of JSON standards, which, you know, JSON has its problems, but it's very simple and straightforward and kind of easy for people to use, which is crucial in any kind of adoption of anything. And things like REST APIs, for anyone sort of non-technical listening, a standard way of communicating between applications that people will follow a pattern and a way of kind of requesting and responding for those requests for those information. So some of the ideas have continued with us, just not in the form that was proposed, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think simplicity is really the key thing. I wrote another article, especially I think the very first article I wrote, which is about the history of JSON. And it's so amazing to see. I think if you go back and look at, there's not a huge amount of data available about this, but if you look, I think Stack Overflow does these surveys, or, you know, there are these Google trend graphs, and you can just look at how JSON took over from XML extremely quickly. And I think it's the same problem. I mean, XML was very much a foundational technology for the semantic web. You had all these different standards that were built on XML. And of course, XML is every programmer's least favorite format, and it's just extremely verbose, extremely complicated, whereas JSON is just so much simpler in comparison. So I think simplicity is really a underrated feature when you're putting out these standards. And I think that was something that was overlooked when it came to the semantic web.
And this comes back again, of course, to the history behind some of the applications and protocols that we use now, the origins of HTML, which is what Tim Berners-Lee is responsible for and the transfer protocol for it, not the internet, as people sometimes say he's responsible for, its origins are in various other flavors of ML, markup language that were used in desktop design and word processing and things like that. They were all, whilst we may look at these tags now and think, what on earth is this? They made perfect sense to people at the time because it was what they were used to. So naturally you carry on using it and you expand it and expand it and expand it, probably to a point where it's falling apart, but it's where its origin story was.
Absolutely. And that's something I get very excited about when it comes to the history of computing. If I can, you know, plug one of my major, what would you call it? A sort of a driving purpose behind my blog, other than just, you know, to write for an audience. I think that's something that to write a history from a technical standpoint, or to, you know, read a history, I think that's a great way to get an understanding for why technologies today are the way they are. And so, for example, when I first started learning web development, I remember being so frustrated because I was just trying to build an app, and I just wanted that, I think they call it the miracle layout. I forget what the term is for it now, but if you just wanted to set up an app, a web application that had, you know, a header, maybe a sidebar, a main content area, it's surprisingly difficult to do with CSS. I mean, now today we've got this new technology called Flexbox, which makes it much easier. But, you know, when I was first learning web development, you didn't really have Flexbox support. So it was surprisingly difficult to lay out a web page so that it looks like an application. And so I found that so frustrating. But what really helps is if you go look at the history of web development, if you go and look at, you know, what Tim Berners-Lee did in the very beginning, as you said, it grew out of all these markup languages. And so the original intent for all those technologies was to, you're creating a document, and the web was really meant to share documents. So of course it's difficult to lay out an application because an application is not a document. I mean, you've got, for example, floats. I mean, you really think when you first start learning web development that if you want to have a sidebar that sticks to the left side of the screen and stays the same width as your content, you really should be using a float. But I mean, the real purpose of float in the beginning was just to have an image that is off to the side in a larger flow of text, like you see in a newspaper. So it's really, it's not what it was designed for originally.
We were doing crazy things like using tables for layout and stuff like that back in the prehistoric days of web development.
Absolutely. So I mean, it's much better now, thankfully, but I found that just knowing the history made it so much easier to understand what was going on, and it made me much less frustrated
So I guess actually fusing these two topics before we move on to kind of the next question, just because I sort of see a connection here. Lots of people have talked about the death of RSS, which I don't know. I'm not 100% sure. I use it all the time. that doesn't mean it's not going to die. And it is mostly an XML-based format, which is some of the reasons people dislike it these days. But also, I mean, the beauty of it is it's uncurated, which, well, it's not uncurated, but where a feed comes from is typically uncurated. Do you think there could be some kind of new RSS that was basically JSON but more user-friendly? So anyone could just subscribe to it in a feed reader like they do now, or is that not the reason RSS is in quote marks dying?
Yeah, I think it's impossible to write an article about RSS and not the title be RSS is dying. I wrote that story and it was a blog post first, and then it got picked up by Vice News. Their tech website published that article of mine, and of course they published it with this banner image, which was, you know, a gravestone with RSS etched into it. So that was a little bit worrying. I mean, people, it's amazing. You get a lot of, whenever you publish something on the internet about how RSS is dead, a lot of people will come out of the woodwork to correct you. So I think I remember reading one post somewhere where somebody made the point, and I think this was spot on. RSS is not really dead, but it's become invisible. It's become the plumbing of the internet. And so I think maybe you could make RSS more user-friendly. But now, I mean, it's surprisingly easy. I mean, I've got an RSS feed on my blog, and enabling that was extremely simple. And I didn't have to understand the format. I didn't have to deal with XML at all. So I'd say that there's almost no cost to adding an RSS feed to your website at the moment, particularly if you're using a tool, you know, a static site tool that somebody else has built for you. So I don't know if making RSS simpler is really that important.
It's pretty simple, yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty pretty simple as it stands.
In fact, isn't that what it stands for? Now I'm trying to remember.
Well, it stands for three different things at once. So. Yeah. But one of them is indeed really simple syndication. So it's supposed to be extremely simple.
I didn't set up that that pun intentionally. I walked into that by chance. and actually, many people don't also realize, as complex and as popular as podcasts have become in recent months, fundamentally, a podcast is an RSS feed containing audio. And despite many efforts to complicate that format, none of them have really happened yet. So actually, RSS is being used a lot in podcasts still, even if it's not being used as much for news feeds anymore. That's certainly where it's probably seeing an uptake in usage again.
Absolutely. And that's another invisible usage of RSS. I don't think I even wrote about it very much in my RSS article. So that was definitely a shortcoming. it's out there. It's being used, but it's hard to, it's not very, you know, visible or sexy.
One thing I wonder if you've picked up on this, like, whilst it's fascinating for people like you and I to learn some of these stories, and actually a lot of the time it's not always technical stories. There's technical details you can dig into which appeal to people who are into that, but there's also just a lot of the human story and the politics, which is equally as fascinating. And a TV show like Halt and Catch Fire, I don't know if you've watched that, is definitely in that vein.
No, never.
It's very good. There's three seasons of it. So it's, you know, and it finished. So there's no, you don't have to wade through like 12 seasons or something.
I'll check that out for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It's very much focusing more on the people side. And it's still quite engaging from that. But I guess that the question would be is, do you think, we'll come to engineers later, but do you think that users of devices and technology need to know these stories? Should they know these stories? Do they benefit from knowing these stories?
When I think about who my audience is for my blog, for example, I aspire to have my stories be interesting and understandable to the average person who doesn't write software every day. But I think that's really only an aspiration. I'd say my target audience is people who are familiar with a lot of the technologies already. And so I think some of the more technical stories aren't really interesting to people who don't build software. And some of those stories, I think, for example, the history of JSON, I think that's very difficult for somebody to care about if you don't use JSON or know what JSON is. And I'm not sure it's really that relevant to you, even if it would be very interesting to an engineer. But I do think there are broader implications of some of the history that could be relevant. So I think, for example, about, I wrote another post, which is about the source history of the cat utility, which is a very popular utility for Unix users. And it does something very simple. All it does is print the contents of a file to the screen, but it's been around for 30, 40 years. And what I discovered in that post is that the actual source code for that program has not changed significantly in 30 or 40 years either. And so that's very interesting. I mean, for an engineer, it's exciting because here's this utility that you use on a regular basis, and it's fun to discover that it's so old. But even for somebody who doesn't use that program ever, and it's not the kind of program you'd ever use unless you were writing software or if you're some sort of power user, even if you're just a regular user, I think it's very interesting to know that there's this program which has been essentially unchanged in 40 years, which still works on your computer. I think it tells you something about software. And I think it's counterintuitive. People think that everything on their computer was invented yesterday, and there's this narrative around tech, which is, you know, everything is new and exciting. But I think it's interesting for somebody, even someone unfamiliar with CAT, to just discover that software can be extremely old.
One that has always interested me, it highlights my own personal area of nerdery. I've been a Mac user most of my life, since the mid-90s. I remember the old Mac OS and then the transition to Mac OS X, Mac OS, OS X, whatever you want to call it. And that has now been around for 15, 16 years in consumer land. And yet probably only in the last year or so has Apple finally removed all the references to the next OS, and especially in the programming languages that you use on Apple platforms, the NS namespacing, which is next step.
Absolutely. I did a little bit of iOS years. Development when I was in college, and I remember there's this practice in that programming language, Objective-C, to prefix everything with the two letters. Yeah. And so you get all these class names that have the prefix NS, and it makes no sense unless you know the history.
Yeah, and to most modern Apple users, they wouldn't know that history. You could read about that story definitely in many, many books, as you already alluded to, in Histories of Apple and Steve Jobs. Yeah. Which story surprised you the most so far?
It's difficult to predict how a story will be received by other people on the internet. And I think that's usually what surprises me. I mean, it's sometimes you find that this story that you've worked quite hard on, you think is really interesting, and then you get some response, but maybe not as much as you're hoping. That's happened to me a few times. But then often you find that a story you write, which you thought was maybe not that interesting, suddenly blows up. And so the story that really surprised me in terms of the response it got was my story about Ada Lovelace. And I have a memory of sitting down in a cafe around the corner from my apartment and working on that blog post. And it was getting long, and I set these due dates for myself, which I don't do a very good job of keeping to, but I was sort of coming up with my due date for the blog post, and I just really wanted to get it done. And so I remember sitting in that cafe, getting through the last paragraphs and just thinking to myself, oh, this is really terrible, but I just have to bang it out and move on to the next thing. And then I put it up, and it gets a huge response. And I think that story about Ada Lovelace is an extremely interesting story, and I think it resonates for a lot of people. So I think that was a big part of it. So I think, there was this political angle there. There was that gender angle, and somehow that was a successful mix. And it was particularly popular on Twitter. So a lot of my stories get out to an audience through news aggregators like Hacker News, which is where a lot of engineers hang out on the internet. But that story, the Ada Lovelace one, was especially popular on Twitter. So I find it very hard to predict which stories will do well, but that one was a pleasant surprise.
I would say it probably doesn't surprise me so much. There's certainly a lot of rediscovery of women's influence on computing recently.
Right.
But I guess, was there anything particularly in the story that surprised you? I mean, we're going back a fair way in history, of course, so I guess some of the sources are harder to find and you can't speak to people who were there, etc. But was there anything in particular in the story that surprised you?
Yeah, there are a couple of things. So I went back and I read Ada Lovelace's paper, and that was a very interesting exercise. It was essentially a computer science paper written in Victorian English. So it was a difficult read, but immensely enjoyable. So that was, it was fun to go back and just get a sense of her style. And it was interesting. The motivation for that article was really, I understood generally that she had written a program, but I was very curious about what does it mean to have written a program in the 19th century? What does it even look like? How do you write it down? And so I went back and discovered that. And essentially, it just looks like a table is the way that she wrote it out. And so that was fun. I'm not sure what I was expecting there, but I wasn't expecting a table. So that was interesting. But then the real surprise for that post was I decided that I would take her table and translate it into something that people would find more familiar. So I wrote a C program, which was basically just her program pulled from the table line by line or, you know, row by row and translated into a C program. And so the C program, I mean, the syntax is all C, so that's recognizable. But it does look a little bit alien since it's a line-by-line translation of her program. But the fun thing about it was that I tried to run it on my computer, and I kept getting the wrong output. And so for 10 minutes or so, I was certain that there must have been a problem with my program. I must have, you know, mistranslated something. And after 10 minutes of banging my head against the table, I eventually realized that there was a division, which was the wrong way around in my program. And I thought, oh, that's really stupid. How could you have done that? And then I went back to the table and I realized that the division was also the wrong way around in the original table. So that was a really exciting moment because suddenly it dawned on me. I mean, it's as magical as I was wrestling with for 10 minutes with this bug, which was 200 years old. And it's surely, you know, if she wrote the first program, then surely this is the first ever computer bug. So it was a bit like, you know, reaching into the past and feeling kinship with her there, just to wrestle with that same bug.
Did a lot of people talk about kind of Ada Lovelace and the first computer program, but did she write others or was this the only one?
That is a great question. I do not know of any other programs that she wrote. I think this was just the one. I mean, she may have written others in her own time. I think this was the only one that was published.
I also see in the post, quite a few people have translated this into modern programming languages. And I guess the important question there, did people make the first pull request? Have they fixed the bug or do they leave it in tribute?
Ah, yes, that's a great question. I think I've seen one other Python translation of that program. And I think in that program, there's maybe a comment in the source file pointing out that this is an error, but you know, in the code itself, the error has been fixed.
Yeah.
But it's also not obvious that the bug is really, it could easily have been a misprint, right? So somebody had to, some poor person had to typeset that page for the table. And I'm sure that, you know, person, as they're pulling together the type, had no idea what on earth they were trying to print and had never seen anything like that before. So I think it's entirely possible that person just got these two variables mixed up. And the variables have, they're all named, you know, V1, V2, V3, for example. And so in this case, the error was that you had a V5 instead of a V4. So it's an extremely small error.
Like coding standards for modern programming languages would have a major headache with that these days.
Absolutely. I'm glad we've moved beyond that.
Just one final question on the Lovelace story. So you said it was basically a table, but I mean, maybe this is sort of naive, just putting a modern interpretation on it, but how did one run it in quote marks?
Well, that was all a little bit unspecified. So there was a plan to build this machine. So Charles Babbage, the British scientist that Ada Lovelace was working with, he had already built this difference engine, which was a relatively simple machine that could be used to automate the production of log tables. And so he had this grander vision to move on and build this other machine called an analytical machine, which was really, I mean, he imagined a general purpose computer. And so this analytical machine was supposed to be a general purpose computer. And they thought that they would be able to program it using punched cards. So that was the plan. They were, you know, maybe 100 years too early. That was indeed what ended up happening, but a long time later. But that was their plan, that they'd build this machine and program it using punched cards. But they never got, the machine was never built. There were some drawings of it, but I don't think they ever got far enough to say, you know, here is the exact sequence of holes you would have to punch in order to begin this particular instruction. So they never got that far. So there's no opportunity for Ada Lovelace to say, okay, now that we've got this table, we're going to translate it into holes on punched cards. However, they knew that there would be certain instructions that the computer would be capable of. And so in this table, she has these different operations. Most of it is, you know, addition and subtraction and moving one variable to another place. And so those that was sort of the basic instruction set of the computer. And even though they didn't have it down to an exact mechanical level, she knew what the computer would be capable of, and so she designed the program using that instruction set.
And have you or will you cover Babbage as well?
That's a good question. I feel like I've covered, I don't know if there's, yeah, I think I've covered a lot. I think the real interesting thing about Charles Babbage, so he has this difference engine, and he never, you know, the funny thing about the difference engine is that it was never really built in full, although they did have working parts of it. And so I think the most interesting thing about Babbage is that he had this working part of the difference engine. And we're talking about it maybe, it's sort of like a suitcase-sized working demonstration of this one part of a machine. And maybe the most interesting story about him is that he has this demo piece and he decides the best use for it is he brings it along to all these, you know, fancy parties and uses it to impress people. You know, shows
it's not
it off
uncommon.
To.
I mean, the story of the Mechanical Turk is the same. People right. took it to parties to show off. That was basically what people used to do in Victorian England.
Right. And maybe it should make a comeback. I'm sure it made for very exciting parties. But I think it's so interesting that he, you know, took it around and showed it off to people and, you know, showed it to Ada Lovelace, who was, you know, a very young woman at the time that they first met. So I think that's an interesting story about him, but I think I've covered a lot of his life in that Ada Lovelace piece. I talked about Ada Lovelace, but I've got a whole section in there on Babbage. So,
what is the most important story so far that you haven't covered yet that you want to?
I'd love to run with that theme that I've discovered a bit in a lot of my articles. I mean, I never intended to start out writing about this, but I've realized over time that a lot of my articles are about this tension between open source development that involves a lot of standards agreed upon by everybody involved, and proprietary development by, you know, large corporations that are trying to monopolize a platform. So I think there's a very interesting political story there, and it seems to come up all over the place. Maybe this is just because I'm so preoccupied by it that it keeps coming up. But I really think there are all these interesting historical stories that touch on it a little bit. So I'd love to keep writing about articles about topics in that vein. And the Friend of a Friend project, which is something I'd like to write about at some point. I first heard of it when I was writing about the semantic web. And it was one of those semantic web technologies that never really took off. But it was a way, I think, I mean, I should really go back and do some more research. But I think the idea was it was just a way for you to advertise who you are and who your friends are on your own website.
Sounding very familiar. Yeah.
Sounds extremely, extremely familiar. And I mean, I really don't know a huge amount more than that. But I think a lot of the features it was designed to support, it was really just a way of keeping in touch with people and spreading contact information. And there was this notion of, you know, a friend link. So you get this nascent idea of the social graph. And I think it's so interesting because whereas some of the semantic, I mean, we were talking earlier about how do you make some of these stories relatable to people who are not engineers? I think the semantic web story is very interesting if you're an engineer, but to the average person, I mean, the semantic web never got far enough to make an impact on the public at large, and most people would never have heard of these technologies. But I think the Friend of a Friend project is extremely interesting because it's an example of something. I mean, it was almost maybe going too far to say it was an alternative Facebook, but it was another path that we could have gone down. And it would have been so different because you would have decided, I mean, you would have advertised to the world who your friends are on your own website. So you would have had control over that information. You could decide to share it with whoever you wanted to. And who knows? I mean, maybe other technologies could have built on top of that. So, I mean, one reason that Twitter took over from RSS, for example, seems to be that you had an opportunity on Twitter to follow people that you knew. So there's this whole social graph built on top of just the idea of a feed of information. And then that was done by Twitter. And, you know, Twitter now is this walled garden controlled by a corporation. Imagine if we had had friend of a friend and RSS, and maybe those two things could have come together and you could have had a lot of the functionality of Twitter, but in this open, decentralized way. So I think I love to write about friend of a friend because I think it's an interesting story about, you know, what could have been.
And these are very relevant stories right now. I mean, on the open source versus proprietary, we currently have a lot of disagreements in the open source community and what especially AWS, Amazon Web Services, are doing to their business models, which is forcing a lot of open source companies to take some drastic steps, which is then upsetting the rest of the open source movement. And these are not new either. These stories are not new. We've had many examples in history like Java and Sun and Oracle and all these companies in the past. We have a company like Microsoft who, I can't remember the exact quote, but once described Linux as a cancer, now being one of the major contributors to Linux. And of course, yeah, the whole aspect of walled garden networks and, of course, the ever-present problem with open source or self-hosted options being that whilst they are ethically and kind of ownership-wise better, they're not always the most usable option, and that's often their big stumbling block. And thus we end up in the walled gardens because it is more convenient. And how do we stop having that problem, I suppose? But that's a much bigger separate conversation, I think. I know you've been studying recently, and the last post was a month or two ago. So what are you working on right now, or is that going to be the next one?
Yeah, thanks for calling me out on that because I've been behind. Definitely been behind. I would love to write about the BBC Micro, so that's my next step. And there's this amazing archive that the BBC has put up. So along with the Micro, I mean, they put out the computer, but then they also put out these television series, which was, you know, teaching people about how to use computers. And I think there's this big worry that the UK would fall behind if the BBC didn't do something like this. So I would love to write about that television program and what it would have been like for, you know, people in the 80s to look ahead and think, you know, what is the computer going to do for our society?
And of course, they released a new one a couple of years ago, which I don't think set the world on fire, but they did it. So I guess that place was already replaced for them with Raspberry Pis and the sort of microcomputers and things like Scratch and stuff. I mean, I guess the need was being filled already.
Yeah, I think there are an amazing number of ways to learn about this stuff now. So if I had to decide on three or four lessons I've learned while writing my blog, I'd say the first one is I've always been surprised. It always seems like it could have gone the other way. And I think it's very easy to sit at a particular point in time and look at the past and just assume that everything was heading inevitably to where you are. But I think particularly when I've written about things like the creation of the web or the RSS standard, I mean, there are just so many different ways that it could have gone. There are so many different people who are around who could have put their own imprint on it. And it always seems to be just a combination of, luck and being at the right place at the right time. So I think it's important to remember that it could have gone in any direction. It was not inevitable. I'd say the second lesson that I've learned is about women in computing. I wrote an article about what it was like to get a Commodore 64. So that was a fun little article. I hadn't done that before, but I wrote that in sort of a second person style. So I tried to put the reader in the place of, you know, a 16 or, you know, 14-year-old boy getting the Commodore 64 for the first time. And there's this whole bit where, you know, the boy sets it up with his father. And I worried a little bit that was quite gendered. You know, why is it a boy? Why is it a boy and his father? But I think the reality is that that's just what it was. I mean, in the 80s, suddenly computers became primarily associated with video games. There wasn't a whole lot else that they could do. Their personal computer was really a video game machine, and that got very gendered very quickly. So in the 80s, computers became for men, but that wasn't the case before that. I mean, there were so many women who worked in computing. So many of the first programmers worked. Some of the first programmers were women because it was seen as a menial thing. So women, you know, computing being more of a men's field than a woman's field, that is a relatively recent thing. While writing that piece, I also learned that this would be my third point. The Commodore 64 was a relatively simple machine, and it came with this manual. And the manual was, you know, a relatively thick manual, but it wasn't quite a book. But that was all you needed to know to operate the machine. I mean, you could read the manual cover to cover, and you would really understand everything about the machine. And you had, you know, it all was based on BASIC, and you had these POKE and PEEK instructions in BASIC, which allowed you to manipulate individual bits of memory. And that gave you huge control, and you could see how the whole machine worked. Whereas I think today, computers are absurdly complicated, and almost nobody understands how every single component of a computer works. So that's a very interesting historical thing that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it might even have been easier to understand computing than today. And then I think the last lesson I've learned, this is my fourth lesson, and I think I've alluded to this several times already throughout our conversation, but I think people underrate how useful history is, learning history, as a way of understanding things. So yep. Particularly if you're working professionally as a software engineer, so much of your job is just trying to understand all these different complex systems. And you could go out there and you could read the specification. You could go out there, you could read, you know, the documentation that comes with that, whatever framework you're using. And that'll get you some of the way there. But I think what people don't usually do and what they should probably do more of is just go look at the history of the technology, because I think that will, understanding, you know, what was the motivating problem and why was this the solution? I think that really helps you understand why something is the way it is. And you can formulate expectations about, you know, if you don't know something, maybe you can expect that it'll work in a particular way because you understand the history and the motivation. So I think that's a really useful tool that people should use.
Yep. I'd go along with pretty much all of those. I think the one about women getting excluded is it's not unique to the computing industry. And I don't really know why it happened. I'm sure someone has written something around it. I guess maybe it's the mainstream adoption of computers is it sort of coincides with that. So I don't know if that was related. But it's a great shame. Yeah. And I think that is now changing, but I think there are crazy statistics to show there are now less women in computing than there were even 20 years ago, which it's kind of crazy. And to show that some aspects, not all, of the male side of computing can be so toxic that it puts these people off. But anyway, that is definitely another conversation, and I don't think we are necessarily the two to have it. So it is pretty damning. The intimidating one I also find quite fascinating. There was a great talk at there's a games meetup here, a regular games meetup here in Berlin, called Talk and Play, where they have some great talks. They're not like programming talks. They're kind of more around culture, and there was a talk from these two French people who kickstarted making an original NES game on 40K in 40K of memory, which, you know, to a modern games programmer is like,
yeah,
is absolutely nothing. and how they did it, and it was such a fascinating talk, and the tricks they had to do, and the things they had to relearn, because, you know, most programmers these days use things like Unity, where 40 kilobytes is probably one arm of a sprite, you know.
So, you mean the game engine? Yeah.
And also things like I was reinvestigating the old Amiga demo scene, where people used to make these discs, floppy discs of just music and graphics, basically. And those things, I think, were programmed in assembly and C, because the performance they had to get out of them at that time to fit on a floppy disk.
Yeah,
you had to really get right down into the nuts and bolts. I learned assembly for one module in my computer science course, And it was eye-opening. It's like learning Latin when you learn European languages, which I also did in my school, so it's a very old-fashioned school.
I did Latin in school also.
Yeah. And it was like that with assembly, like you're writing four pages of code to add two numbers together. It makes you appreciate something like Ruby far more, you know, because you suddenly realize what on earth is the complexity going under the hood. And I think sometimes just appreciating that is helpful. So my three points are pretty similar to yours in many ways. And actually, one thing I completely forgot to mention at the beginning of this conversation is one of the other reasons that I was interested in speaking to you, one of the reasons why I ended up learning so much, especially about 80s computing history, was a couple of years ago I started working on a board game where I wanted it to be about running a computer company in the 80s. And I got stuck on mechanics very quickly. But in the interim, I did a lot of research. So learned a lot of obscure stories and less obscure stories. So I guess some of my points are based on that research, plus the kind of stuff I do as a day job, which is basically interfacing with engineers to try and explain what they do to the rest of the world, which opens you up to a lot of experiences.
Sounds like a challenge, yeah.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. The first one would be short-term and current success doesn't always equal long-term success. I mean, a classic example of this right now is someone like Apple, incredibly successful at the moment, but in the mid-90s, the company nearly went bankrupt. And we already talked about companies like Sinclair earlier. You know, just because you're successful now doesn't mean you will be in the future. And maybe your business model will be completely different. That's something you maybe just have to go with sometimes. Obviously, I have to throw this one in to fit in with the name of the show, but do not underestimate the amateur, which I sort of mean here in terms of open source, I guess. So many programs and components of programs we now use have basically been built by people in their spare time, which is quite fascinating. And sometimes these people are lucky enough, or if they want to be, get picked up by bigger companies and get a proper job in quote marks, maybe working on their project, maybe on something close to their project, but quite often not.
I think there are a lot of examples out there as well the open source version of something out competing the proprietary version. Yep. So, I mean, even when there's direct competition, often the open source version will come out ahead. And I think if you look at the history of RSS, I think that's particularly illustrative here because you have this amateur, Dave Weiner, who comes out with his version of RSS. And then there's Netscape that comes out with its version of RSS. And arguably, I mean, Weiner's version is the one that kind of saw a lot of success. There's a lot of back and forth there, but he was the one who decided to use it for podcasting. So yeah, I think here open source often does better. The amateur often, if they're enthusiastic, they win out in the end.
Yeah, certainly that. And I may even contradict myself slightly with my last one, and this is something I kind of say a lot, and it's sometimes controversial, and I sometimes am told I'm wrong, and I kind of agree with it when I'm told I'm wrong, so it's a bit of an odd one to say. But firstly, maybe it's kind of point three and a half. Maybe this is sort of a sub-point of the same point. Firstly, especially at the moment with a lot of artificial intelligence systems and automated systems, I would always say just because you can build something, don't. Don't you always have to. It may not always be the best option. History, again, is littered with examples of engineers having their work abused by others. It's, again, part of a wider... We're getting a little bit more serious and dark here maybe, but you know, sometimes if you think this could be used for bad, maybe just don't build it or keep it to yourself. I'm not sure.
Right.
And the second one, I guess, is reinventing the wheel a lot. And so where I've got contradicted on this is where sometimes I'll say, why are there five libraries that do this exact same thing? Why don't they all get together and collaborate? And then people say to me, well, you know, sometimes you need competition, and competition is good, and even though they're 95% the same, et cetera, it's not a bad thing per se. So I flip backwards and forwards on that point. But I think more specifically, and this especially feeds into our topic, has been coming back to understanding some of the history behind things. Like, for example, a lot of coding schools now teach very practical skills, but they miss out a lot of theory, things like common patterns for algorithms and things like that. And I've heard a lot of people complaining about engineers coming from these schools because they will come in and propose something as a revolutionary new idea. And people say, well, that's an idea that's existed for 20 years. You know, so I think it's sometimes, I guess, just doing a bit more research before you build and just understanding that maybe it existed before, maybe it got abandoned before for a reason. Don't be afraid to talk to people more experienced than you. Sometimes they, you know, may be annoying and be sticklers for things, but sometimes they may also have advice to give you. So teams don't spend too much time kind of recreating things that actually already existed. Yeah. I think I've gone broader than you, maybe. I'm not sure. But
great point, though. I think it ties into my thing about knowing the history of computing and how that can be useful. I think it's just software engineers as professionals. I mean, there is really very little institutional memory. You know, people, if some technical idea has been discarded, then I think people tend to think, well, it was discarded, so we don't need to learn about it. But actually, you know, it's very useful to learn why it was discarded. So that would be my appeal too for people just to spend more time learning about the history of computing.
One of the great places for learning that history will be your blog. We mentioned what it's called. Maybe it wasn't entirely obvious of the URL. So the URL is 2bithistory, 2 as in spelt out, T-W-O-B-I-T, history.org. I think you have a slight hexadecimal joke on the website. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's right. A slight joke. That's my style of humor. I go for the slight jokes.
I think it's hexadecimal. I'm not 100% sure. But apart from 2-bit history and I guess the accompanied 2-bit history Twitter account, if there's anything, any other ways that people can find out some of the other things you do, if you want to share them, what are some of those?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm currently in graduate school and at some point I'd like to be employed again. So if you're interested in employing me and discovering all my employable skills, of which, of course, there are many, you should check out my personal website. And that's SinclairTarjay.com.
And of course, if you need an employee who has all that historical knowledge, then I think you're the person. So
yeah.
You have been listening to me, Christian Chiller, speaking with Sinclair Tarjay of 2-Bit History, where we discuss computer history, the untold stories, the surprising stories, the maybe not so surprising stories behind the history of the computers we all now use, know, maybe love, depends who you are, I suppose. I hope you are enthusiastic about knowing more about computer history, about digging more behind the tools and applications and operating systems and devices that you probably use every day, and are more curious about finding out about how they got to how they are now. For more information on The Enthusiastic Amateur, go to theenthusiasticamateur.com. You can find their show notes, and you can also apply to be a guest on a future episode. No sales pitches, no marketing spiels, but if you are interested in what you do and feel like you have something to add, I'd love to hear from you. So until next time, stay curious, stay passionate, stay enthusiastic.